Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Noam Chomsky, the US anarchist and linguist from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, is in London. Also, Angela Balassi's back to talk about public relations. What is it? And Rupert Murdoch's Bible. Yes, I bet you didn't even know you had one. More from Gail Ripplinger. Dialects produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. And we start this week with Noam Chomsky. He's been in Britain, in fact, in London over the last few weeks, and he's been speaking to Melvin Bragg. Remember Melvin Bragg from the South Bank show? That got scrapped by ITV. Well, Melvin Bragg is very much alive and kicking. He's been doing a programme on Radio 4 on Thursday mornings called In Our Time as well. But he was at something called the British Academy. Not the Royal Academy, the British Academy. He's one of the most well-respected linguists in the world. Linguists really talking about speech and language and how it all works at the very highest level. And he also talked to Melvin Bragg. In fact, Melvin Bragg asked him about anarchism and why, for him, being a linguist also meant that he was an anarchist.
Thank you very much indeed, and I'm sure many of you will want to take up parts of that wonderful talk later. But Professor Chomsky asked if we could, for some time anyway, talk about the other big part of his intellectual life, the anarcho-syndicalism, etc., and your intellectual views. Before, as a link, do you see a connection between what you have been talking about now and the political views which we call anarcho-syndicalism?
I think one has to be cautious about that. There's no logical connection. Like, one could believe what most psychologists, philosophers and linguists believe, and have which is quite different from this, and have the same political views. That would not be a logical contradiction, and conversely. Nevertheless, there's a kind of an underlying suggestive connection, which actually has historical origins. So there was a time, 18th century, when there were similar basically at the time when classical liberalism emerged, late Enlightenment, Wilhelm von Humboldt. Adam Smith, Rousseau, to an extent, the early Marx. You put this together, there were ideas about the nature of language and the nature of appropriate social systems, which were similar. They were based on the conception, goes back to Descartes was actually the first to formulate it clearly, not the social aspect, he was quite reactionary, but the basic idea that the essential property of humans as distinct from other organisms was a kind of creative capacity which manifested itself most clearly and centrally in language. So there's a kind of Descartes, his criterion for the, everyone knows that Descartes distinguished body and mind. His basic criterion for identifying mind was the ability to use language in the normal, creative way. Creative in the sense that we all have the capacity to produce new expressions, new in our experience, new in the history of the language, and to do it in a way which is appropriate to situations, but not caused by situations. So the particular situation, say, that I'm in now, does not cause me to produce the next sentence I'll produce. I could decide to talk about the weather in Boston or something. It wouldn't be appropriate, but I could easily do it, have that capacity. So you can do this endlessly without limit. and it's true of all humans. You have a capacity for a creative activity not caused by external or internal circumstances, but appropriate to them in some way. That's a total mystery, I should say. It was a mystery in the 17th century. It's a mystery today. It goes beyond standard physical assumptions. Modern physics is based essentially on two principles, determinacy and randomness. Everything that can be accounted for is accounted for either as determinate or random. The same is true of general theory of computation. So those of you who know Turing machine theory, general theory of computation, know that it's either determinate or random. But apparently human intelligence goes beyond that, which is quite mysterious, but it's evident to all of us. We can act creatively in this way. New expressions, appropriate to situations, eliciting, not caused by them, eliciting thoughts in other people which are new to them but which they comprehend. So that's just normal human behavior, totally distinct from anything known in the animal world and not easy to explain in physical terms when you think it through. It's just as mysterious now as it was when it was pointed out in the 17th century. Now, what does this have to do with the way society ought to be organized? Well, the conclusion that was drawn by, say, by Rousseau, by Humboldt and others, is that any social system which inhibits human creativity is unacceptable. People should be free to inquire, to create, to realize their own potential, to develop their own creative capacities, which are internal to them, without external imposition of authority or force or domination. Well, that's the core principle of classical anarchism. It's an outgrowth of classical liberalism. Classical liberalism ran aground on the rise of capitalism. The two are incompatible. Capitalist systems are incompatible with classical liberal ideas. And the residue that persisted is what led to the core of the modern anarchist tradition, sometimes called libertarian socialist tradition. That's the connection. It's not a logical, right? It's a connection of sort of, I don't know what, the spirit or something like that, which was discussed and articulated in the 18th century and has raises some interesting things to think about, including the nature of this creative capacity. What is it? And is it correct that a society that in some way limits, constrains, and controls it is illegitimate? Is it illegitimate to have social structures of any kind that involve authority, domination, hierarchy, coercion? Are these fundamentally illegitimate structures? If they're not, they have to justify themselves somehow. They have a burden of proof. They have to show that they're legitimate. Maybe that can sometimes be done, but that they have the burden of proof. Authority is not self-justifying. And it sort of is rooted in conceptions of human nature of this kind, which were discussed in interesting ways in the 17th and 18th century.
How did you yourself, how did your interest in anarchism begin?
It began in childhood. Actually, the first article that I wrote, that I can remember writing at least, was I can date it exactly, it was February 1939. It was about the fall of Barcelona. And it started by talking about the spread of fascism, Austria, Czechoslovakia, Toledo, Barcelona. Barcelona's the end of the anarchist revolution in Spain. Actually, it had ended earlier, but I didn't know that at the time. So it looked, and about at that time, I began to go hang around anarchist bookstores in New York. There were emigres, Spanish emigres, fleeing from the residue of the revolution. Actually, as I say, I didn't know it at the time, but the revolution had already been destroyed 2 years earlier. It existed in 1936, but it was crushed by the combined efforts of fascists, communists, and liberal democracies. Now, they disagreed on all kind of other things, but they agreed that liberty cannot be tolerated. So it was quite successful, but it was crushed. Now, this doesn't enter much into official history because, you know, the existing system of power don't like to look at it that way. But I think you can see it. If you read Orwell's Homage to Catalonia, he was in the kind of quasi-Trotskyist militia, Pum militia. So, and as he says, he didn't really understand what the anarchists were doing. He is very honest about that. But he says there was something good about it. He could sense that there was something important happening. And he describes how it was crushed, mainly by communists in May 1937, but with the collaboration of the liberal democracies and of course the fascists who were supporting Franco. I didn't know that at the time. But in fact, I didn't read Homage to Catalonia, though it was published already. And there was an interesting reason. It was suppressed. Orwell's British publishers would not permit it. I mean, I think they published a couple of dozen copies or something. It was essentially unknown. It was anti-communist. And that was just not tolerable in the climate of the time. So it only appeared years later as a kind of a Cold War document, anti-communist Cold War document, which I'm sure would have horrified Orwell. It was after his death. So I didn't know that book until much later. But there was a lot of material around, pamphlet literature, left journals, even talk with émigrés, which kind of made all of this alive. Later I learned more about it.
You're already into your studies, but did this discovery of anarchy and the excitement that you felt, but did that lead you on a course to action, that you were determined to do something in the largest political arena possible, whether it was the streets or in writing pamphlets or whatever it was? Did that lead you to a course of action that you followed?
It did, but just personally, the main, this was right in the early days of the Second World War. And I was a young teenager, so not doing a lot of things politically, but there were lots and lots, there's a wide variety of activist political groups, but I was never able to join any of them because they were all, virtually all of the functioning ones were either kind of mainstream liberal, I wouldn't accept that, to the right, pro-fascist, and they existed, of course, all over, or the so-called left groups were almost entirely Bolshevik. And I was anti-Leninist, strongly anti-Leninist. I thought at the time that the Bolshevik Revolution was the worst disaster that had ever befallen the socialist movement. I still think that. So it was kind of closed off from direct political participation. And my own personal activism happened to be mostly connected with Palestine. I grew up in a, as you mentioned, in a Jewish environment. My parents were politically kind of Roosevelt Democrats, though much of the family was unemployed Jewish working class, all kinds of political radicalism. I was very much involved in what was then the Zionist movement, it's now called anti-Zionist, efforts to create a binationalist, Arab-Jewish, working-class-based socialist community in Palestine. It may sound exotic now, it wasn't so strange in the environment at the time, something like that could have been possible. That was a large part of my own political activism up till 1948, when that ended for obvious reasons.
Can I just ask a couple more questions, because you yourself wanted to bring this in? Can you just say how your protest at the war in Vietnam played into your, how your views played into that?
Well, the 1950s were pretty quick. I should say, in the early 40s, I was very strongly opposed to British imperialism. So one of the moments of, you know, dramatic moments of my own early teenage life was the British invasion of Greece, which I thought was an utter horror story. I wrote about it, talked about it, and so on. But this went on through the 40s. You know, you know what was happening in that period. The 1950s were a pretty quiescent time. Nothing much was happening. There was a lot, it's called McCarthyism, but it was much broader than that. There was a kind of a massive suppression of independent thought, independent action, very much like after the First World War. First World War, the labor movement in the United States was simply wiped out, revived in the 30s, but it was practically destroyed. In the early 50s, a huge assault began against labor. It's pretty well studied in scholarship, and people who live through it are aware of it. But there was a massive attack to try to undermine the kind of out of the Second World War came a kind of a radical democratic spirit around the world, all over, and in Europe and in the United States, everywhere. And the first task of the victors, the United States and Britain, was to crush it. In Europe, they had to crush the partisans. The first actions of the British and American armies were to crush the partisan movements, which were basically radical democratic, and that was intolerable. So, and this was incidentally under the British Labour Party. When the British forces moved up to northern Italy, British and American forces, they discovered a functioning society. The Italian partisans were a strong movement. They had essentially driven out the Nazis. The British and the Americans had to destroy them. They had developed a cooperative, functioning society. The British Labour Party was appalled at the fact that workers were managing their own firms without bosses telling them what to do. That was completely unacceptable. And the Americans, of course, even more so. So in Italy and Greece, similar things in France, even in Germany. One of the reasons for breaking Germany up into two sections, which is expressed by George Kennan, one of the leading architects of the post-war world, was that it was necessary to wall Western Germany away from the East. Interesting turn of phrase. The problem was that in the East there were radical labor-based movements developing, and the West had to be protected from that. So we had to wall it off from the Eastern influences. This went on all over Europe. And the same was happening at home. So massive assault on labor, and it was a pretty quiescent period. Getting to the Vietnam War, the right time to have become involved in it was early 1950s. And there was just no imaginable way to do it. By 1961, it was becoming much more serious. This is not the normal history, but if you look at the actual facts, when Kennedy came in, John F. Kennedy, in 1961, he very quickly escalated the war sharply. In 1961-62, he authorized the U.S. Air Force to carry out bombing raids in South Vietnam. They did it under South Vietnamese markings. So the planes had South Vietnamese markings, but they were American planes piloted by Americans. The facts kind of dribbled through, but nobody was paying attention. He also authorized napalm, authorized chemical warfare to destroy crops and livestock, began programs to drive the peasants into what amounted to concentration camps, called strategic hamlets, where they were surrounded by barbed wire to protect them from the guerrillas who they were supporting. Facts we now know that this was understood from internal documents, but that was the, you know, kind of propaganda. It's pretty clear if you looked at it what was going on. So at that point it was possible to begin talking about the war, but in a very narrow way. I mean, the first talks that I was able to give were literally in people's living rooms or in a church with four people, you know, the preacher, the organizer, a drunk who walked in, a guy who wanted to kill me. But that was a typical audience. And this went on for a long time. It's kind of suppressed now, but it's worth knowing. Those of you who are old enough to remember and participate may recall that there was an international day of protest against the war in October 1965. And by that time, South Vietnam had been practically destroyed. North Vietnam was being bombed. There were hundreds of thousands of American troops there, so there was an international day of protest. I lived in Boston. Boston's maybe the most liberal city in the country, or close to it. We thought we would have an outdoor demonstration on the Boston Common. It's essentially Hyde Park, where everything takes place. So there was a march to the Boston Common. I was supposed to be one of the speakers. It was broken up by force, and mostly by students, violently broken up. The liberal press praised those who were breaking up the demonstrations. How dare these, you know, unpatriotic people not support our noble troops, and so on and so forth. The next international day of protest was in March 1966, and we realized we couldn't have an outdoor demonstration to be broken up. So it was in a church. The church was attacked, you know, a lot of police around, couldn't do anything, and so on. It was only 67, 68, that you really began to get protest. And England, it was worse, incidentally. The person who was really running pretty much the international anti-war movement, and especially in England, was Peggy Duff, who some of you may recall, wonderful person. She had to bring in speakers from the United States to give talks to demonstrations in England. I came a couple of times. I.F. Stone came a couple of times, and nobody wanted to say anything here, practically. And this went on for a long time, same elsewhere. I mean, there's all kind of illusions that have been created about it, but it was quite a while before things really took off.
That was Noam Chomsky there, speaking a couple of weeks ago in London at the British Academy, with Melvin Bragg interviewing him, talking about anarchism and anarcho-syndicalism and why that relates to his work as a linguist. In fact, one of the most preeminent linguists in the world. And you can also see more of Noam Chomsky online, particularly his film, which was made back in the 1990s, called Manufacturing Consent, which is all about the media and how the media is used to get consent for policies which people otherwise might scream and shout about.
We are American. Americans know power belongs in the hands of people.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. We know things are bad, worse than bad.
Bad.
They're crazy, 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 crazy.
10 seconds to commercial.
Sometimes extreme behavior can be the warning sign of a mental illness. Learn to see the sickness.
The President of the United States!
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
The sickness.
Regrettably,
bloodshed.
We now believe
strife.
That only force
riot.
Will make him leave.
Right.
I am certain our cause is just, a gallon of gas. And I am certain our cause is moral, loss of life. And I am certain our cause is right.
Give me the goddamn money. A new world order.
I don't know.
It's going to be all right tonight.
Lying.
Again.
I'm from the United States of Kiss My Ass.
Stupidity. Again.
Demonstrations of this kind are demoralizing the whole country.
Again.
Don't hate the media.
media.
It's up to you. Choice. It's up to you. Change the world. It's up to you. Please do your part.
We want to know what the truth is.
Television is not the truth. Television is a goddamn amusement park.
Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave. Regrettably, we now believe that only force will make him leave.
The protesters are a tiny but vocal minority. The American people overwhelmingly support the president of the United States.
We've sent out into the world.
That was Steinsky and Mass Media. It's Up to You on the label Ninja Tunes. The catalog number ZEN 1211. That's ZEN 1211, was on vinyl and 12 inch, released in Britain in 1992.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, now I'm joined by Angela Balassi. Hi, Angela, and welcome to Dialect.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Now, we come to talk about public relations, because I know you work in public relations. I'm not sure if our previous speaker, Noam Chomsky, would be really a big fan of public relations. But anyway, give us an idea. What is PR?
It's about organisations or people communicating with the public or media. It's aimed at creating or maintaining a positive image, but it's also about building relationships.
But isn't that part of the problem, that you're constantly trying to project this positive image? It's about maintaining a brand and or that kind of thing, and making people feel good thoughts about it. It's a bit just like advertising, really.
No, I think it's very different to advertising. Advertising is about selling the product or the service, whereas to my mind, PR is about telling about, you know, the story about the person behind that. It could be a charity, it could be a social enterprise, not-for-profit, or it could be a business itself.
But it could be a big corporation, can't it? They spend a fantastic amount on PR, don't they? And let's not pull any punches here, because they see it as a tax write-off as well. I mean, for example, a big corporation like Shell will spend millions, possibly even billions, on positive public relations, going to the extent of giving money to a related environmental organisations, what they call greenwash.
So the idea of corporate social responsibility in order to be seen as a good organisation, but also to have tax benefits. I'm sure people obviously do, but that is also a misconception. Not everybody who gets involved in PR has that in mind. I mean, I deal with, I say, a mixture of organisations, charities, social enterprises, and also small to middle-sized businesses. They don't have these massive budgets, and they also do it for, you know, various other reasons about getting known, about telling the reason behind why they do what they do.
Okay, what's your background then? What does it typically prepare you for working in public relations?
Well, my background is journalism. I started out in Italy about 10 years ago, and then I went on to work on the local...
Hang on, about Italy, that sounds... how did you start? I'm assuming you're an English person, you're British.
I am, yes.
Yeah, so how did you get started on journalism in Italy?
Well, I did a work placement in Italy to begin with, so I went out and then I also taught for a while, got a certain level of Italian behind me, and then I applied to do a work placement on a magazine and an online publication out in Italy. It was a case of it was in English and Italian, and so that's how I got started and got the experience. And then I came back to the UK and got my first job on a newspaper with the Henley Standard.
Okay, and what was it like day to day working on a newspaper? Because you've, I mean, for example, as a writer, I mean, the pressure is on you to get through as many stories as possible. So you're never really going to be able to do them maybe as much in depth as you'd like to. So how did it work from day to day? Give us an idea of a typical day on the Henley paper.
Well, you've made a good point there. I mean, when I started, we did have more time, so we could do stories more in depth. And that was part of the reason why I did get out of journalism. In fact, it got to the point where I didn't feel that I could do a story as much in depth as I'd like to. And we're often behind the desk for most of the day and rehashing other people's articles. But the day-to-day at the time is a case of, you know, you'd sometimes get diary jobs. You'd have to go out to them, could be going to court, could be going out to meet people, or it could be what we call sourcing our own stories. So you get to know people in the community, find out what could be newsworthy, what could be of interest to the readers in that area.
So how long were you working there for?
The Henley Standard, that was about a year and a half, 2 years.
And what changes did you see? Because I know journalism is changing fast, you know, over that year and a half while you were there.
Well, they made cuts shortly after I left. So they went from 5 reporters down to 4. But even when I was there, we had to take our own photos, whereas in previous times you used to have a photographer.
Oh, okay, so this constant cutting back, how does that actually affect the quality of what people are reading in a newspaper?
Well, it becomes a case of filling the space and not necessarily not always with quality. Because if you have less people, it stands to reason that you can't provide the same quality.
When you were saying also about rehashing other people's stories, whose stories?
Well, PR. So it would be a case of press, PR companies would send through articles. And yes, you'd have to rewrite them to your own house style, change them, etc., so that they would be, so they'd fit in with the newspaper.
And over that year and a half, how many times did you actually manage to source a news story from one of your own sources? That is to say, somebody that just had, maybe on an estate somewhere, had a story to tell, and you managed to find it, wrote it up and put it in the newspaper?
Well, with the Henley Standard, quite a lot, actually, because that was one of my first jobs in journalism. But I noticed as the time went on and I went on to work for other newspapers, in fact, even a daily, but, you know, that was less and less each time and as the years went by. But the Henley Standard, I'd probably quite easily do maybe, I don't know, 1-2 a week.
So there's lots of journalists I know that have given up journalism and gone into PR. So, I mean, there's lots in this city, for example, because there simply aren't the journalist jobs there were, for example, at the Western Daily Press, the BBC, ITV, have all sacked, made people redundant over the last 20 years, probably only about a third of the total number of journalists in Bristol for a big regional centre than there were 20 years ago. Why the move into PR, first of all, for you specifically?
Okay, well, as you've explained, you know, there have been cuts in journalism. So for me, it was both push and pull. So I saw that journalism, especially for newspapers, it was struggling as an industry and it was difficult to move on. Whereas in the past, you used to work on a weekly, then a daily, and you'd move your way up to the nationals. It became less and less of an opportunity because there just weren't the jobs available. So I didn't see how I could progress much further. But also there was a pull side. I started doing some PR for a friend of mine who ran a social enterprise. And in the end, she actually was awarded an MBE and she took me along, which was very nice. And so I saw how it benefited her and how it could do some good.
What about this pulling in another direction, that is in a more commercial PR direction? How did you, have you managed to sort of lay out your career so that you can salve your conscience to a certain extent by working it less commercially, that is to say less kind of veiled advertising and more with a social conscience PR?
Well, that's the beauty of working for myself. I get to decide who I work with, how I work, and also have more control over the articles. So for me, again, going back to advertising, it's not advertising, or at least it shouldn't be. It's about telling a story. And so at the end of the day, it should hopefully enlighten, inform, or even entertain people.
Also sounds to me, from what you were saying just now, that the Henley Standard, you were starting to lose some of your ideals about what you got into journalism to do. So why was that?
Well, to be honest, it wasn't the Henley Standard. I left that place to move on to another newspaper. So, but it was further down the line where I did feel like I was losing the reasons why I'd gone into journalism in the first place.
Where and why?
Okay, it was in a newspaper in Wales, and that was the last newspaper I'd worked on as a staff reporter. It got to the point where sometimes you could be covering a council meeting for 3 hours, and it also a case of more often than not, we didn't get to cover courts anymore, we didn't get to go out and meet people that much, and it was a case of rehashing press releases. So basically I was rewriting articles for other people.
Okay, so what do you like about your job now as PR?
Well, I like the fact that I actually get to write the articles in the first place. So I get to source the stories. I do it from start, you know, just from the beginning to end. I get to source the stories, interview the people, write it and craft it, and then send it out.
And what don't you like?
Well, that's a good question. it's the insecurity sometimes because I'm self-employed. It's also running my own business, which can be quite difficult. And also being on the other side. I don't actually like sometimes having to chase journalists.
Ah, right. Yeah. So it's basically going back to people and saying, I thought you were going to use this story, you haven't used it, is that right?
No, I don't, to be honest, there's no obligation for them ever to use it, so I wouldn't say that, but it's just a case of, have you received it? Do you think you're likely to use it?
So, yeah, and you've got to do that in order to build up a relationship with people if you think that you're doing stories that they will want to use. And also, of course, you can get a bit of feedback by chatting to journalists saying, well, I didn't like this angle, or it wasn't local enough or something. OK, so what are the common misconceptions? For example, do you have to be a big firm, spend lots of money?
Yes, I mean, you don't have to be a big firm. In fact, you don't even have to be commercially orientated. It could be, as I said before, for a charity and not for profit. But even if you're a small firm, even if you're just a one-man band, it's still possible to do it either by yourself or by taking somebody else on to do it for you without having to spend thousands of pounds.
And what's this crisis management aspect of PR? This is one of the interesting, I mean, because, you know, sometimes organisations have a diabolical news stories about them and they just don't know what to do. And the fact that they don't know what to do often means they do nothing, and that can be a disaster in itself.
Well, we were always told when we worked on a newspaper that to say no comment is bad. So you always should give a reason or an explanation, and where appropriate, an apology as well. I think it's important to be upfront, to own up to mistakes that you've made. But I think what helps with PR, if you've done it steadily beforehand, then you can sort of, you have that support and that backing behind you when things do go wrong.
Because hang on a minute, because the government do that all the time. I'm always hearing on the radio and seeing on television and reading in newspapers that no minister was available to comment or that kind of thing. So that's a no-no, is it?
It might, to my mind, it's a no-no, because you're not acknowledging the issue. And as we were saying earlier about the whole idea of feedback, about improving, how can you do that if you don't even acknowledge it in the first place?
It's even more naughty for the government if they're spending billions of pounds of our money and then they're not prepared to come out and say what's happened when things go wrong. And let's face it, they go wrong quite a lot, don't they? So have you ever done any crisis management?
I haven't, fortunately, touch wood. But I do say to people from the start, PR is as much about your behaviour than simply me just writing articles for you. So there's no point me writing nice positive articles if you don't have good customer service, you don't treat people properly.
Okay, so what kind of people do you deal with?
It's quite a mixture. So I deal with a charity called SAFE, Standards Against Female Exploitation, which is against human trafficking. Also, a not-for-profit, a lady who helps run retreats for people affected by breast cancer. But then more on the professional services side, it's solicitors, a letting agent, and people more interested in the lifestyle industries.
Because the people trafficking issue has been big over the last few weeks, hasn't it?
It has. Yeah, it's been in the news. I think it's coming into the news more often now. I think it was something that possibly people weren't as aware of in the past.
Called modern slavery. How come it's got to such proportions?
Well, I don't know why it's got to such proportions. I think possibly it's being reported more rather than it having got to more proportions.
Maybe, yes,
now.
Maybe it's been sort of underground, and in a way you've done a terrific job in actually getting people talking about it.
Well,
I mean, it's not just you that's done it, obviously, but you've helped there. What was it about that particular organisation that appealed to you from your conscience point of view?
Well, interestingly, in fact, when I worked in Italy, I noticed that it was a big problem. And in fact, I used to teach English to police officers who dealt with human trafficking. And so I became aware of it 10 years ago, but didn't feel I was in a position to do much to help. And so after I got into journalism, just by chance, I met this organisation at an event and got talking to them. And they told me about one of their survivor stories, which I was keen to share with other people. And she's now written a book, in fact. So it was a case of I saw the good work they were doing and how there's so much more to be done. But because they're such a small charity, I felt that I could have more of an impact and be more useful, whereas a big organisation probably would already have an agency
okay.
involved.
For anyone listening that knows of possible areas where public relations might be helpful, might be useful, because I mean the thing is, as you're working as a freelance, how does that relationship work with the business? Because they might only need your services a few times a year.
That sometimes happens. Sometimes people maybe get an award or some accolade and they want people to know about it. So it could even just be a one-off. But generally speaking, I would say it's a case of it being a campaign, the constant recognition. So it does work better if you at least do it for a certain time period, a few months.
And what advantages would you have as a PR, someone who's worked in mainstream journalism? I mean, how does that help you do your job as a PR?
Well, because I know what the press are looking for. So it's not just about getting out there in the first place. It's also about getting the message you want out there. Because if you send something in, it's not maybe written clearly, even slightly, you know, slight mistakes or slight ambiguities can then be misinterpreted. So the way I present it, it's clear, to the point, it's more likely to be used and more likely to be used the way people intended it to be
used. Okay, and what are the benefits of PR?
Well, there are many benefits. There's the intangible benefits, so it can boost morale for staff, it can raise awareness, it can help get known. But also, I've known people to say they've got business out of it directly, or for charities to say it's boosted, you know, their fundraising efforts.
Okay, tell us about one story when you were working in mainstream journalism that you remember that's stuck in your mind, because you must have done thousands of stories over the years. You know, sometimes one, and I, you know, someone who's worked in journalism myself, doing journalism now, I suppose, really, some things just stick in your mind, don't they?
A PR story?
No, I'm talking about from mainstream journalism, where you were working with, you know, working in the Henley paper or the Wales Welsh paper.
Yeah, there was a lady who'd beat cancer 6 times.
What?
And she was, yeah, to say the least, quite an inspirational lady. She also had children she looked after. She's part of various organisations in the community, and she was just upbeat and kept on going, and also tried to raise awareness about the condition. She had throat cancer, and I believe she was only in her 20s at the time. She didn't drink, she didn't smoke, she certainly wasn't a typical candidate. But despite all this, she still had a, you know, cheery outlook on life.
Well, this is one of the things about journalism. When you turn up for work, you never know quite what's going to be on your desk that day.
Indeed.
All right. Angela Balassi, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Back in the late 1990s, the Prophecy Club in the United States took a series of unique insights into prophecy. Not Old Testament style, but modern prophecy, with the focus on how the Bible could be speaking directly to us today. Gail Ripplinger is a US writer who uncovered some shocking ways in which Rupert Murdoch's version of the Bible, the translation which he owns is called the New International Version, misses out entire phrases from the original Greek, deleting references to fasting and prayer, for example. And even whole sets of verses are gone, as they are from the New King James Version, which Gail believes has been altered. So here's Gail Ripplinger talking about what she found researching her book, New Age Bible Versions, continuing on from last week.
And this particular article that I'm going to be telling you about was called Equidistant Letter Sequence in the Book of Genesis. And several Hebrew scholars took the Book of Genesis. But they took the book of Genesis, and using a computer, they discovered equidistant letter sequences. They found embedded in the text of the Hebrew Bible the names of people, number one, and not people that like Moses and that sort of thing, but people who lived in the 1900s. It included not only their names, but the day they were born, the day they died, and the cities they were born and died in. Now, these were in the Hebrew text, not, you know, written straight out, but they were equidistant letter sequences. In other words, like every third letter would spell their name, or every fourth letter, or something like this. It could be across, down, diagonally, and only a computer could pull all of this information out. The men that they found, the names of the people that they found, were people that lived in the 5th century, 6th century, 10th century, 19th century. Now, the Bible says in the book of Revelations, this book, the book of life. And I wondered after I saw this article, I wondered if when people are removing these things, if in fact they are removing their own names from the book of life, because he said if you will take from the words of the prophecy of this book, God will take your part out of the book of life. And so it may be that our names are written in the Bible. And the day we're born, the day we die, and the city we're born and died in. And it could be the very Lamb's book of life itself. You know, the Bible says that Jehoiakim in the Old Testament begat Jeconias. And that's an obscure kind of fact that most people don't know. But when you read the book of Matthew, it said Josias begat Jeconias. And that would appear to be a contradiction. But what God did is he took Jehoiakim's name out of the Bible, because Jehoiakim in Jeremiah chapter 36 cut the prophecy of Jeremiah. He destroyed it. And so God took his name out of the genealogy in Matthew chapter 1. So God will do what he says he will do. Now, two Harvard and two Yale mathematicians took this statistical science article and evaluated it. And they said the chances of this happening are 1 in 50 quadrillion. And these two unsaved, or four unsaved scholars said, quote, the phenomena cannot be attributed to anything within the known physical universe. They were astonished. And I think it's very exciting to know that we have the very words of God. He said, the words that I've spoken unto you, the same will judge you in the last day. And if God's going to judge us by those very words, he must give us each and every single word. Now, there's an interesting sidelight to what's happened here in this research in statistical science, and that is the Hebrew text that they used here is the Hebrew text called the Ben Hakim Rabbinic Bible that underlies the King James Version. All right, they tried the same mathematical analysis with the Samaritan Pentateuch, and it didn't work. It does not work with the manuscripts underlying the New International Version, the New American Standard Version, the Living Bible, Good News for Modern Man, Contemporary English Version. It doesn't work with that Hebrew text. That is a different Hebrew text. It's called the Stuttgart edition, and it's a corrupt edition that was created around the turn of the century by a gentleman named Rudolf Kittel. Now, Rudolf Kittel, when you look his name up in the Jewish Encyclopedia, you will find that he is, number one, anti-Semitic, and number two, has contributions in his writings from the Hellenistic mystery religions. And so for those people who knew him at that time, he appeared to be an anti-Semitic person in his writings, and so the Jewish people have never accepted his Hebrew translation. However, when you go into a Christian bookstore today, what you will find is that Hebrew text underlying the NIV and the NASB and these modern translations, and that's very much in part why they are so different. But I can't imagine God using an anti-Semitic person. As a matter of fact, Rudolf Kittel's son Gerhard was tried and convicted of war crimes in the slaughter of the Jewish people. He was Hitler's high priest, and he created slanderous propaganda against the Jewish people. So his whole family had been anti-Semitic. And fortunately, the King James Bible does not use that Hebrew text. Okay, now part of the reason I wrote the book New Age Bible Versions, this is the book I wrote, and I spent 6 years collating the modern translations of the Bible. Years ago, I was not a staunch King James believer. As a matter of fact, when I would write letters to my mother, I would change the Bible anytime I wanted to. I really wasn't educated about the subject, and I was a young Christian. But I found that the young ladies who would come into my office at the university, I was a professor and they knew I was a Christian, and when they had emotional problems, they would come into my office and cry, and I would show them a verse in the Bible or something to help them feel better. And I noticed that those who were using the modern translations seemed to be unstable, emotionally depressed, anxious, all those sorts of things. And it made me stop to think perhaps that's why psychology has moved into the church, because of some of the problems these versions have caused. But as I was collating those translations, impeded by my love for these young people at the university who seemed to be having problems, and I really wasn't quite sure that it was coming from these versions, but I saw that there was a problem. I looked in Matthew chapter 4:18, for Jesus came to heal the brokenhearted, and that verse is completely omitted in the new versions. Looked at something simple like be of good comfort in Luke chapter 8, entirely omitted. The mercy of God, entirely omitted. As a matter of fact, the mercy seat, which is 53 times in the Old Testament, has been entirely omitted in the NIV. No more mercy seat in the NIV. So it's sort of some kind of a lid now. I don't know what kind of a lid it is. But, Mark chapter 3, power to heal the sick, completely omitted. Acts chapter 3, the lame man was healed, completely omitted in the NIV. Okay, now, they've created a caricature of God, I found, in the new versions. For instance, when we've got Ephesians, Jesus nurturing his church. Nurturing comes from the word nurse, as a mother would nurse her children, holding them lovingly. Okay? Or humble, 1 Corinthians 12. God nurtures us and he humbles us. Okay? In the new versions, it says discipline and humiliate. Now, can you imagine wanting to go to a God who was going to discipline and humiliate you? I can't imagine either. And now I see why those young ladies that I suggested go home and read their Bible would come back and they would be more depressed than they were when they left. Now, we're going to be looking at some of the omissions in new versions, and what you will find as we go through these omissions is that the omissions in the new versions serve to make the Bible accommodate other religions. Now, if you were a marketer, you would know that that would increase your market share. If you can include other religions, then you can sell more Bibles. If you can include every denomination, not just born-again Christians, but the liberal, you know, seminaries and the liberal churches, if you can include everyone, obviously you can sell more Bibles. This is what's happened. Now, the main tenet of the New World religion is tolerance for the religious beliefs of others, all right? So you could say the New World religion is inclusive. It includes everyone. As a matter of fact, it will even include Christians if you want to join. All right? Now, Christianity is exclusive. Jesus said, "No man cometh unto the Father but by me." All right? What you will see in these new versions is that they allow a broader kind of a definition. Now, looking up at these samples I've shown you here, a simple verse to teach a child is 1 John 4:14, the Father sent the Son to be the Savior of the world. Okay, all one-syllable words. But we have one Father, the Father, one Son, one Savior, and one world. Okay? Now, when we look in the new versions, NIV and NASB, you will see that they have a God, one of many, who sends a Son or avatar with a message to each age. And so with the new versions, you will see a gospel, a message, a God, a Son, a Savior, and an age, rather than the God, the Son, the Savior, and the world. One way or many ways.
Gail Ripplinger there, talking about what she found researching her book, New Age Bible Versions, speaking about Rupert Murdoch's New International Translation of the Bible. Shockingly less accurate than the King James Version from the 17th century. That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk or find our blog. Thanks to our guests, Noam Chomsky, Melvin Bragg, Angela Balassi and Gail Ripplinger, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect to Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
we get a gospel dance record as good as Sounds of Blackness's Optimistic or this one, Lisa Taylor's.